on to our time certain, remaining item time certain for 3 o'clock, 698.
Before we read that, we found a lost pair of keys. If you've lost your keys, they're up here.
Okay. Item All right, 698, please.
Establish a construction excise tax to fund affordable housing initiatives from an inclusionary housing fund.
Commissioner Salzman.
Thank you, Mayor. As all of my colleagues know, the lack of affordable housing is the greatest crisis facing our city right now, and the current market conditions are increasing the crisis. We have thousands of people literally living on our streets. We have unprecedented rent increases, more than 15% on average year over year, the highest in the nation. The rising rents, coupled with extremely low vacancy rates, have made affordable housing options scarce for low and middle-income Portlanders. And quite frankly, new development, both residential and commercial, is continuing to put more stressors on the need for affordable housing. We have worked hard in this city to ensure that jobs are located close to where people live. And I think that was one of our cornerstones of the comprehensive plan that we adopted yesterday, is people need to be able to live near where they work. And we have been succeeding, but we need to ensure that more people can actually afford to live in our city near to our jobs. We need to ensure that people who comprise our workforce have places to live and raise their families. We need to ensure that seniors who have lived their whole lives in the city can afford to stay here near their support systems, their family, and their places of worship. We have a documented need right now for 24,000 units of affordable housing. And that need is growing as the city continues to grow. In the comprehensive plan that we adopted yesterday, we acknowledged the need for an additional 10,000 units of affordable housing on top of that 24,000 units of need right now over the next 20 years. New commercial and residential developments in the city must pay their freight towards supporting affordable housing, both commercial and residential development. And that's what we're presenting today to you, is a proposal to do exactly that. We are proposing to establish a 1% commercial excise tax on residential construction and on commercial construction. This is not the solution to our housing crisis, but it is an important cornerstone of funding new affordable housing in the city of Portland. Some of the other things this council has done is last year we increased the amount of urban renewal money dedicated to housing by nearly $67 million for affordable housing. Before the end of this year, the council will consider an inclusionary zoning program for adoption, which will include some incentives for developers, which this construction excise tax will provide some funding for. And I will be bringing to council a referral to the voters in a couple weeks to ask them to help solve this affordable housing crisis even more by supporting a general obligation bond for affordable housing development. Our city's workers, our families, our seniors are struggling to stay in this city. It will take all of us stepping up to help stem the tide, to help turn the tide. And I'd now like to introduce our Housing Bureau Director, Kurt Krieger, and Matthew Schibold, our Equity and Policy Manager, who will run us through the proposal in more detail. And then we just have one panel, invited panel, that I'll bring up after the PowerPoint and the presentation by Matthew and Kurt. And that is Dyke Dame, who is a member of the Portland Housing Advisory Committee and who was instrumental in the city's lobbying effort regarding the tax and inclusionary zoning. Vivian Satterfield of Opal, who also helped lead the charge in Salem on getting the inclusionary zoning ban lifted, and Jess Larson of the Welcome Home Coalition. So we'll start with Matthew and Kurt and the PowerPoint.
Thank you very much, Mayor Hales, members of council. Kurt Krieger, Portland Housing Bureau. It's my pleasure to be here today with Matthew Schibold. And I want to frame this briefly by saying that today we come to you standing on the shoulders of giants, and that is our legislative leaders brought us to where we are today. You, as a council, made the passage of an inclusionary housing program, a mandatory inclusionary housing program, your top legislative priority in the 2016 session. And in 32 days, we were able to get that passed, due in large part to your energy, your enthusiasm, and your commitment. And although Martha Pellegrino is on leave, Martha, I know, worked 12 hours a day on this because I got calls from her after 8 p.m. and on weekends. But specifically, Senator Alan Dembrough was the prime sponsor of Senate Bill 1533. Representative Alyssa Kenny Geyer, chair of the House Human Services and Housing Committee, and Speaker Tina Kotek were all directly involved in the details of this bill and the creation of the construction excise tax option for all cities and all counties in the state of Oregon. The underlying purpose was to tap the hydraulics of the private sector to deliver a wider spectrum of affordable housing than we could do with direct public financing. To summarize, the Senate Bill 1533 provides for mandatory inclusionary zoning above 80% of the median family income, and it allows for and recognizes that the use of voluntary inclusionary zoning below 80% of MFI is statutorily permitted. At the same time, they lifted a preemption on the levying of local construction excise taxes for affordable housing. This authorized all cities and counties except for Bend, who had previously enacted a construction excise tax prior to the preemption. And I think it's noteworthy to say that with Portland's leadership, every city and every county was benefited from this action. With respect to the recommendations of the Housing Commissioner and the Bureau, we're bringing forward to you the residential tax of 1% of the permit valuation on all new residential development. That is the maximum rate set by statute. We're also bringing forward a recommendation that simultaneously that a tax on commercial and industrial property be levied at the rate of 1% of permit valuation for all new commercial development. And I would add that that is authorized by statute, but not so limited. As far as how the funds would be used, we have broken this down into a couple of program themes. One is the legislature allowed for a 4% allowance for administration. That would be administered by the Bureau of Development Services, as they are the transaction counter for all building permits. The remaining sum would be divided as follows. 15% of the residential tax would be sent to Oregon Housing and Community Services for purposes of down payment assistance in the state of Oregon. I've already begun talking with OCHS about how that might be used in Portland. If the council levies the tax, we'd very much like to see that spent within the city of Portland, and we have many culturally specific nonprofits doing this work already. Of the remaining sum, 50% would be set aside for inclusionary zoning incentives, which are meant to be offsets to the cost of private development compliance with mandatory inclusionary zoning. And the remaining 35% would be made available for affordable housing for households under 60% of the MFI. The commercial tax revenue, we are recommending that 100% be allocated to housing for households under 60% of the MFI.
Just to clarify on that previous slide, for the residential, those percentages are set in state law?
Those are statutory requirements, yes.
And what's the statutory requirement for the commercial?
The commercial statutory minimum is that 50% has to be spent on housing. The other 50% is not so governed by statute. It's fungible.
Does the state legislation speak to the issue that the city budget office has raised about commercial, whether multifamily housing is commercial or residential?
Well, the issue for those of you that are not so well familiar with BDS, as Commissioner Fritz would be, is that multifamily permits in the city of Portland are classified as commercial. Permits for mixed-use buildings are classified as commercial, and that is how they treat them in the context of building permit approval. The legislative intent to us seems quite clear that the drafters, Senator Dembro and Alyssa Canning Geyer, that were directly involved in the creation of the bill, had focused on use of the property. So there are at least three references in the bill that we believe uphold the allocation of funds according to use, not permit classification. The other thing that's important to realize is that this is a statewide bill. Different cities, different counties process permits differently. And were we to take a standard to which worked in Portland, it would actually be the more liberal construction. This might sound counterintuitive, but by focusing on residential, we are indicating that the more conservative definition would apply. So if there was a court challenge later on, we don't have to refund anybody for funds that may have been misallocated.
I was just clarifying. Yeah. I know you have the rest of your presentation. Yeah. I just wanted to know, was it in statute? Because we can come back to this later.
Yeah, there was a lot of, just so you know, a single-family residential is exempt from mandatory inclusionary zoning, but in this context, we are recommending that the CET apply to it. And because the home builders were at the table with the realtors, there was actually quite a lot of intensive negotiation around the residential portion of this bill. And so we're very confident with that legislative interpretation. With respect to exemptions, the first category are required state exemptions: affordable housing at or below 80% of the median family income, public improvements under public contracting codes, public or private schools or hospitals, worship, agriculture, or nonprofit care facilities are all exempt. We are proposing at least three additional. One is affordable for-sale housing. As a council, you're providing incentives to contractors to provide affordable housing. It's the HLTE program. We think that this should work in concert with the HLTE program and recommend that households that are affordable for sale be exempt from the excise tax. In addition, as a council, you've also provided a waiver to the system development charge for accessory dwelling units, and we think that these should work in tandem, and we're recommending that accessory dwelling units be exempt for a period of 2 years, which is the same period of time that you've exempted them from SDCs. We've gave a lot of thought to the minor home improvements that households make. The statute speaks to increased square footage, so if someone encloses a porch or finishes out their attic, we don't think it's necessarily appropriate to be taxing that use, and we would recommend that improvements that have a value of less than $100,000 be exempt from the CET. We looked at both 10 and 5-year historic trends, and the next chart, slide 6, goes into the detail of both commercial and residential revenue trends. We selected in our modeling a 5-year trend because it included the worst of the recessionary period of 2010-2011. So I must add that this is permit value by use, not by permit class. In the historic estimates, the next slide imputes what that raises. The 5-year annual average for residential would be about $2 million. Of that, 15% would be provided to the Oregon Housing Community Services. 50% would be made available for inclusionary zoning incentives, and 35% remaining for other affordable housing programs. And as you can see, of the commercial revenue, 100% would be allocated to affordable housing programs. So that's about $8 million per annum, and I think it's important to focus on per annum because some of the press have taken this slide to mean that it means $8 million over 5 years, which is incorrect. To put this in context, in the Bureau's budget of $150 million, this would constitute about 7% of the total budget going forward. The other thing I'd like to say is that with the Council's prior action having to do with short-term rentals, Airbnb, VRBO, which is taxing tourists for affordable housing, your efforts to harness the tax increment financing for affordable housing. Now with this construction excise tax, everyone is paying. That is, private developers of both housing and commercial and industrial property would be contributing. The next two slides gives specific case studies. Working with the Bureau of Development Services, we were able to pull specific single-family permits, specific multifamily permits, industrial and, big box retail and commercial permits. And it's useful, I think, on slide 8 to note that the housing commercial excise tax would total about $3,700. It's in context with the other fees charged by the City of Portland. And it is less than many of the other fees and SDC waivers. With multifamily new construction, the example given would raise about $114,000. And again, compared with other SDCs, that is a smaller sum than both the schools and the parks amounts. Big box retail, again, a new construction would generate, in this instance, about $111,000. You can see the SDCs for transportation are obviously much higher. And in the case of commercial construction, about $60,000 would be raised with the instant example in context with the other fees and SDC charges. So to put this into context, and I know you've seen these numbers in different forms before, but to frame the need, we have at present in the Housing Bureau portfolio about 14,000 housing units. We're adding to this all the time, and I think the last time we met, Commissioner Fish, you asked about the Brawna. Residents are now moving back into the Brawna. It is basically preserved as an affordable property, part of your 11 by 13 portfolio. So this has grown since the last time we met because we're completing projects as we speak. And we have about 1,500 new affordable units in the production pipeline, up about 50% due to the fall supernova that we processed in October. So we have a remaining deficit, a shortage of some 24,000 units, which was stated in the consolidated plan that was before you last week. And in addition, the comprehensive plan that you enacted yesterday identifies an additional need of 10,000 affordable units by 2035. So that's the universe of need. We pair that with these various funding sources. As Commissioner Saltzman mentioned, the recalibration of TIF, the so-called TIF lift, increased the amount of TIF money from 30 to 45%. That would generate $155 million from 2016 to 2035, about 1,550 units. The short-term rental funds, thanks to your approval of our 2017 budget, we're going forward with the securitization of that revenue with a revenue bond with the finance office this summer. That would generate, over the period of 2016 to 2035, about $18 million. With respect to the residential inclusionary zoning incentives, using the trend analysis that Matthew prepared and that we've just summarized, we would generate between $47 and $57 million as offsets and an additional $31 to $41 million in affordable housing revenue for residential only. And then the commercial sector would be contributing between $45 and $55 million. So each of these are important parts of the solution to affordable housing. The mandatory inclusionary zoning was contemplated in the 2035 comprehensive plan. I know for some folks this might sound like something new, but it was really framed in the context of your 20-year vision. And so we are now implementing, the day after you've enacted the plan, we are now moving to implement the plan, wasting no time. Developer offsets are stipulated requirements to mitigate or partially compensate developers for the cost of compliance, and the proposal for you before you today begins to accumulate the funds necessary to provide the necessary offsets. So by the time we come back to you in the fall with a mandatory inclusionary zoning program, we'll have money accumulating to provide the developer offsets. It's important to mention that the threshold income of 80% of the median family income and above contained in Senate Bill 1533, as enacted, in and of itself does not help Portland fulfill our equity goals. We were seriously concerned about the bill as drafted, But the CET, both the residential and the commercial construction excise tax, will be instrumental in helping us to buy down affordability for households at 60% of AMI and below. And finally, and in conclusion, perhaps most importantly, these funds can be used anywhere within the city of Portland. We're not confined to a specific geographic area as the open urban renewal areas is often in the case of TIF. So this is a momentous day. We're here to answer questions that you might have, and of course the panel coming up behind us will further elaborate. Thank you.
Let me jump in if I could with some questions. And you've got three members of the panel up here that are fighting some kind of flu or cold, so we'll all struggle through this.
Charlie and I are scared.
Yeah, it's like we're surrounded.
And I believe that we've traced the original source of being Dan Saltzman.
Yes. Always my fault.
Otherwise known as patient zero.
I think that's a HIPAA violation. I think this is a momentous day, and I want to drill down on a couple of the details. And I'm tempted to offer a couple of friendly amendments, but I first want to make sure I'm on the right track. Of the 24,000 units in one of your earlier slides that were short, what does the Housing Bureau estimate are the number of units for people who have either no money or up to 30% of median family income are we short? And I just want to, because I think we talk about numbers and they seem very abstract. 0 to 30 MFI means someone with no income, means a full-time minimum wage worker, means an older adult on disability. So let's put the human face on it. It's a lot of people in our community who are now completely priced out. Of the 24,000 units that we need, how many of those do you estimate are for people at 0 to 30 median family income?
Well, specifically, 17,530.
Okay. So a majority of those units.
Indeed.
And I think that's important because I think we're going to have to, in order to make a dent where the greatest need is, I think we're going to have to be very clear about where the money is directed. So that's helpful. The ordinance in, I guess it's the recitals under Section 1, says the city of Portland has a critical need for housing affordable to households earning at or below 80% of the median family income. The impact statement that accompanies the ordinance says the purpose of this legislation is to authorize a construction excise tax on residential and commercial development to fund the production and preservation of affordable housing at or below 60% MFI. I want to see if we can avoid confusion here. Because the ordinance talks about 80 and below. The impact statement makes clear we're talking about 60 and below. Is there a reason that we don't just amend recital 1 to make clear that the need is at 60 and below?
Well, the need is at 60 and below, but I think since the statute is driving us towards assisting households at 80, that we encompassed 80 in the recital.
And that's the one thing I want to avoid is a general statement of 80 and below that conflicts with our specific intent to go 60 and below with a heavy focus on 30 and below. And I don't want there to be a future council that gets confused.
And for the record, Matthew Schaubold with the Housing Bureau, what I would offer on the first recital is that for the revenue that is sourced that the Bureau would be able to use for affordable housing production and preservation, the intent would be to be 60 and below. But the incentive fund associated with the mandatory inclusionary zoning program would be at both the 80% and below 80% levels.
So, Kurt, could maybe at some later point, could you see if there is a friendly amendment that would be acceptable to the sponsor that takes the very clear statement in the impact statement about the purpose of the legislation and just incorporates it into the ordinance? Because we generally don't use impact statements as being legislative history.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, this is the first reading today, so we have a week here to perfect any desired changes that my colleagues have. And I'd also say that we will bring back to council this fall a proposal on how we should allocate the funding below 60% median family income and commit to not spending any of these resources until the council has approved that policy, other than potentially spending some of these funds on the purchase of the Oak Leaf Mobile Home Park.
So that was Dan is telepathic. And so thank you, Commissioner Salzman, for putting that on the record. So just to be clear, these additional revenue sources that we're going to be debating, all of these funds in the aggregate would come back to council for a discussion about how the money is targeted. So yes. What percentage goes to the poorest of the poor and what percentage goes up the ladder. And so we don't, it's what I think Dan is suggesting is we don't have to have that debate now. We can have that discussion when we know the total amount of money that's available, and then the council can weigh in on how it's to spend. Kurt, is that your understanding?
We agree.
Okay. The I'd like to ask you a question about the so-called inclusionary zoning incentives. And it's under your residential improvement proposal, it's where 50% of the net revenue would be dedicated. Kurt, could you remind us what exactly the legislature provided in terms of our opportunity to buy down from 80%, and how flexible was the legislation? Is our only recourse to buy it down with money, or are there other ways at our discretion that we can offer a benefit that has the effect of buying down the rent?
Well, the statute basically contains a list of tools that we must provide, and then an optional list of items that we may provide. For example, we must provide developers with the opportunity for whole or partial fee waivers or reductions, whole or partial fee waivers of system development charges or impact fees, finance-based incentives, or full or partial exemption from ad valorem property taxes. It's important that you know that this is all or in part. This is not meant to be a dollar-for-dollar offset, and we right. spent a lot of time, probably 2 weeks, in Salem on this very point, because we're not underwriting their projects. Therefore, there's not a dollar-for-dollar offset, but there is a good-faith effort. In addition, in order to provide for affordability at or below 60% of median income, we can provide optional additional services, including density adjustments, expedited service for local permit processing, modification of height, floor, or other site-specific requirements, and additional financial incentives, which would either allow us to increase the number of affordable housing units over and above the base of 20%, which the statute allows for, decrease the sale or rental price of affordable housing within the unit, or build affordable housing units that are equal to or lower than 80% of AMI. So they've given us a menu of choices. We have the A list, if you will, of mandatory requirements, and the B list of optional requirements. And the CET offsets the compliance with the A list, and it helps provide the necessary capital to buy down rents below 80% of AMI on the B list.
That's an incredibly comprehensive and clear answer. And my recollection is that while the city would have preferred a lower ceiling on inclusionary housing, that is, the city original proposal said 60% and below, the legislature adopted the 80% and below. And so the fallback position was to create as much flexibility as possible in what constitutes a buy down. At what point in the process do you come back to us with your interpretation of that language and recommendations for what meets our good faith requirement?
Well, Matthew is co-chairing the panel of experts for inclusionary zoning. Some of the speakers later today are on that panel, and we thank them for their time and talent. By the end of September, the basic construction of the inclusionary housing program will be complete. So we'll be coming back, I believe, after September 30th. Isn't that correct, Matthew?
I believe that as a land use action, there'll have to be some hearings with the Planning and Sustainability Commission in advance of coming back to council, and council couldn't take action on an IZ program before the end of November.
I think it's our hope to have something before council in early December.
Mm-hmm. Two more quick questions. This proposal anticipates that all the revenue would go into a new fund, the Housing Bureau Inclusionary Housing Fund. And what was the thinking behind creating a new dedicated fund and putting all these revenues rather than using a portion of these revenues in the existing Housing Investment Fund, which you have established as a very flexible fund for lots of purposes?
Well, I think we wanted to compartmentalize the funding because the HIF, as you know it, includes program income from the sale of real estate. It includes other revenue, and we didn't want to commingle that revenue.
Is it more of an accounting thing?
Yes,
it's not. It does. Does it? In making that decision, does it bind you? Does it limit you in any way, or is it more of an accounting?
It's an accounting segregation issue, if you will, for internal cost control.
And my final question is, in the you mentioned in response to Commissioner Fritz that the allocations for the residential CET are guided in part by the legislative requirements. But my understanding is the 15% for the Oregon Department of Housing and Community Services was prescribed, but the 50%, 35% split was not legislatively required, was it?
Yes, it is.
Both?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that we can't alter.
Correct. Correct.
All we can, we have the discretion of how we spend that 50% and how we interpret the legislation. And then on the 35% that goes to affordable housing under the residential improvements and the 100% of the commercial improvements, Commissioner Saltzman will be coming back with a recommendation of how those are allocated. Mm-hmm. Final question, there's a proposal that's been floated to create one or more exemptions for otherwise laudable purposes. The one that caught my attention is brownfields. And have you had a chance to evaluate that, and do you have a view on it?
Well, it was discussed as we were presenting or preparing this for your review. We had conversations with Planning and Sustainability. We had conversations with the Portland Development Commission. And frankly, even when we did the study tour to Denver, I had conversations with Central East Side business owners about how this would factor into their work in the industrial sanctuary area. We decided to leave those out and let them make their own case to be exempted from it. One of our concerns was that while there was a great deal of interest in exempting all of the economic development sites from the city, was that many of those sites are being occupied by global corporations that for which a 1% construction excise tax is a negligible issue. For example, the Cascade Station property would have included IKEA. I'm not sure that 1% makes a difference to IKEA. So we felt that that policy choice needed to be yours after you hear the testimony.
And do we have the option if the council want me? The reason I mentioned brownfields is it's the centerpiece of our industrial land strategy in the comprehensive plan that we just adopted. And one of the principal barriers that we've identified to meeting that goal is the cost of reclaiming brownfields and the difficulty mixing together the financing necessary to convert brownfields to productive use. Could the council, through this exercise, decide to carve out a discretionary exemption, unlike the ones that you have on the chart where there are certain categories that are exempt by class? Could we come up with a brownfield exemption that has some discretionary component where on a case-by-case basis, if you meet certain criteria, you might be eligible?
Well, I think the answer to that is probably yes. Matthew might have a different opinion. Certainly the city attorney would want to probably tell you for sure. But there's nothing in the statute that would prevent you from exempting indigenous small business. I think you might want to look at the wage structure of some of the businesses that go here so that we're not inadvertently exempting businesses that are perhaps unaffected.
Yeah, so I know we have people waiting to testify, so I'd like to have a follow-up conversation about options for tailoring a brownfield exemption in order to advance the city's industrial land strategy. Thank you.
Okay, other questions?
I share that desire. In fact, I have the city attorneys working on a brownfields potential amendment, which would need to bring next when we have the second hearing. I want to go back to the issue of classifying commercial multifamily as either commercial or residential. And I want to start out by saying that unless somebody has something, some reason for not dedicating 100% of the commercial to affordable housing, that's where I start from, because I do believe that taxes work best when there's a nexus between the purpose of the tax and what you use it for, and what's taxed. So given that, and I haven't heard anybody else on the council saying that we shouldn't have 100% of the commercial going to affordable housing, although I think we have some discussion about what purposes that might be. But given that, why would we want to classify multifamily as residential when we know that that means 15% of the taxes collected in Portland will go to the state and may never come back?
Well, we do think that the drafters intended that residential use be treated as residential property. That, frankly, we didn't explain to Senator Dembrough in drafting this bill, and some of the drafting occurred in this building, that the city of Portland processes every multifamily commercial permit as commercial rather than residential. So as they work through the details of the bill in the 32 days of the short session, I think the residential use was always intended. There's at least three references to it in the bill, which we think upholds that interpretation. The city attorney has looked at it on behalf of the council budget office, and I think the recommendation is that your legislative intent in this deliberation be made clear as part of the record, so that if a future council wants to discuss it, at least they have that background.
Well, I think we should have some more discussion about that right now, because we know that, at least last time I checked, 40% of Portland's property taxes never come back to the Portland area. And I'm, for one, I'm not happy about $750,000 a year going to do affordable housing in other parts of the state. If there's a possibility that by classifying multifamily as residential, that means that if we can keep it as commercial, that means all the money stays in Portland and all that money can be used for affordable housing. The other concern I have is that the ordinance says that it's for production and preservation of affordable housing, the 50% of the commercial that's allowed, that's not dedicated specifically by the statute. And I'm wondering if there's an interest from the community and on the council for including operations as a potential use, operations of affordable housing. If we pass the general obligation bond to build a lot of publicly owned affordable housing, we're going to need money to operate it from. And so I'd be interested in allowing future councils to decide how to use that money for affordable housing and broadening it just slightly.
I understand the point. All I would point to is that the volatility of this fund source is such that in bad years, if we're funding operations, it will put pressure on the general fund. Because if the money declines, and we know it will because it's tied to cyclical construction, that there will come a time when you're going to hedge that with the general fund, which will be the same time the general fund is under extra pressure due to business losses.
Yeah, but that also goes that if this can't go to it, that all of it puts pressure on the general fund. So I would suggest that there's, especially when it's not mandatory, which percentages are going to what purposes, future councils might be given that option.
Yeah, I think you would want to be judicious in how you apply this, so you didn't create a bow wave on the general fund at a later date.
I would just add, for perspective, I think there's nothing that prevents a future council from coming back at any point and saying we want to revisit how we allocate the commercial excise tax between operations and capital. But I would also argue that right now the most urgent imperative need is capital. We need to get more units on the ground, either preserved or new. And so I would argue that we save the operations argument maybe for a later date and focus on new affordable housing production 100%.
Okay.
Presumably, since this is a dedicated fund, the Budget Advisory Committee of the Housing Bureau will be making a recommendation to future councils as to the allocation of the money.
The Portland Housing Advisory Committee?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yes, and we'll be reporting on this in the context of the annual state of housing. So as the funding is accumulated and dispersed, we'll be counting those units and reporting in a robust manner so that you can see how we're fulfilling both our geographic and our equity goals.
And even in a perfect world, the new affordable housing that might be funded by the bond that we haven't passed yet wouldn't be online for a couple of years, right? So I think I would like us to consider that at least.
Okay. More questions for Kurt and Matthew, if any. All right. Thank you both. Thank you very much. Okay, you have a panel to call?
Yeah. Dyke Dame, who is a member of the Portland Housing Advisory Commission, Vivian Satterfield, member who works for Opal, and then Jess Larson of the Welcome Home Coalition. And as Kurt or Matthew said, both Vivian and Dyke also serve on the panel of experts that is advising the Bureau and myself on the inclusionary zoning policies that we'll be bringing forward in the near future.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Yeah. Dyke, you want to kick things off?
May I borrow a Kleenex from one of you guys?
Yeah. Really? I'm loaded with Kleenex. I've got three people with colds.
I have not.
Just waiting for the testify?
I have not had a cold for 10 years. I don't know whether it's the subject matter or you guys.
I think blame us.
Spending more time with Dan than the rest of us, so I think we now have nailed this this scientific inquiry down.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak about this very important issue. I think some of us that have worked on this are pretty passionate about this. I'm going to limit my comments to the commercial excise tax component. I think the other side of it is pretty well set in stone and is not going to be interpreted much differently than what you see it before you. The key thing for me is that 96% of this commercial excise tax revenue be devoted to the production of affordable housing. The city did a great job. They worked hard with the state legislature to get inclusionary zoning. Those efforts produced a bipartisan support from the state legislature, and that 96% is going to be critical in order to make inclusionary zoning work. It's our job, city's job, all of us, to make it work, because I know from my trips to Salem, we're not going to get another shot at this. We did a pretty good job of getting this approved. Now it's up to us to make it work. And we can't make it work unless we got enough money. And so unless we devote all of these funds to accomplish this, we won't get the job done. And we don't have another chance to go back and ask. We're certainly not going to be able to ask some of the bipartisan support that we got on this deal. That'll be the end of it.
Thank you, Doug.
Do you have a... excuse me. I'm catching it already. Do you have some feedback on the... whether multifamily should be commercial or residential?
I think if the city has already processes multifamily projects as commercial, then I guess it's commercial. I wouldn't parse it that way. I'm not looking at that side of it. I'm just looking at the resolution on the left hand, on the, I guess it would be the right hand side. Where does the money go? And I hope it all goes to where I think it should go, and that's to affordable housing.
I think we're all agreed on that. I'm just trying to get more to go to affordable housing in Portland.
Can I just ask you a question? We got a couple letters from trade associations objecting to this proposal on different grounds. You're a respected developer, private, you've done commercial and residential development. What is your reaction to some of the pushback we're getting?
Well, I don't know what the pushback is, but I'll just, if there is some, I would speak to it this way. We all live here. We all have an obligation to help our community continue to be a good place for everybody to live. And if we're going to push people out of the city because we're unwilling or unable to all collaborate and work together and try to make things pencil and do the job, then we're not really doing our job as citizens, if you will. So I'm not real interested in listening to people gripe about, well, we shouldn't do this, we shouldn't do that. We got a problem. So you want to be 75 years old, get kicked out of an apartment, and have no place to go? No.
And just for context, on the commercial side, you've been in the real estate business for how long?
40-plus years, probably.
In the last 40 years, has there been a period of time in Portland's history where the commercial market has been hotter and there have been more aggressive rents and profits?
Well, I'm no expert, but you know, I think your statement's probably accurate. That I think that your statement is that it's as good as it ever been right now, and we also know there's a business cycle, and nothing lasts forever. So, I don't know if I'm answering your question or not.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks very much,
Vivian.
Next. Mayor, Council, good afternoon. Vivian Satterfield, I'm the Deputy Director of Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. Opal builds power for environmental justice and civil rights in our low-income communities and communities of color. We work at the intersection of transportation, housing, and health, fighting for greater self-determination, equal protection, and access to opportunity where we live, work, play, and pray. I just want to give a little bit of context as for, you know, how we got here today. It's been described as being a momentous day. In the late 1990s, Metro initiated a process to really analyze a broad range of housing, land, and land use tools to ensure both an adequate supply and equitable distribution of affordable housing across the region. At that time, they had identified inclusionary zoning as one of those potential tools. However, in 1999, a state prohibition passed the state legislature, preventing jurisdictions from adopting policies that require housing set-asides in private developments at target income levels. In intervening 15 years, with rising rents and housing prices across the Portland metro region and other housing markets across the state, low- and moderate-income families have been increasingly pushed out to the fringes, further from jobs, good schools, and healthy community centers. At Opal, we first took up the issue of lifting the ban on inclusionary zoning in 2010, and at the time we were seeking for a clean lift alongside the Community Alliance of Tenants and the Center for Intercultural Organizing, now known as Unite Oregon. We led efforts through three legislative sessions, building momentum in a large and diverse coalition that brought racial, social justice, and health equity partners to the cause, as the lack of access to affordable, stable housing in areas of high opportunity increasingly became the number one issue for communities across the state. So with SB 1533, passed recently by the Oregon legislature, we've cracked open both inclusionary zoning and the construction excise tax. And I believe the intent all along by legislatures was that the CET would be used towards affordable housing. I want to acknowledge, however, that with all this hard work, we are still far short of where we should be and where most other places are with IZ. And the statutory limits on the CET make it weak as well. There's an ever-increasing urgency here, both in the city of Portland to address our housing needs, as there is across the state. And I appreciate the deliberate intention to implement the CET tool as soon as legally possible to capture revenue. Many essential systems that serve the public are supported through impact fees by the way of SDCs, such as transportation and parks, but affordable housing doesn't have one. Collecting a construction excise tax in the midst of a booming housing market and reinvesting in our community's greatest needs is the right step to ensuring that our communities are accessible by the way of affordable homes. As a member of the Inclusionary Housing Panel of Experts working to provide input on the city's development process for IZ, it's good to see that the city is moving quickly on the CET, half of which is dedicated towards the incentive funds needed for when a mandatory IZ policy is adopted in the future. It's good that we are maximizing the residential side of the tax as allowed under the state statute, and we are supportive of the city's efforts to move quickly to implement this revenue source for new affordable housing production and preservation. On the commercial side, however, while I can understand why it's also being capped at 1%, despite having no such limitation in state statute, I remain unconvinced that we're truly maximizing this revenue source. I look forward to the findings in the upcoming Nexus study and financial feasibility study in the inclusionary zoning process to see if there's a basis for a higher tax rate. Many of Opal's members are the low-wage workers who will labor inside these new commercial buildings, yet are forced to live far from their jobs because of the lack of affordable housing. The impact of these developments in a hot housing market needs to be captured and maximized in every instance and quickly. Thank you, Commissioner Saltzman, and the team you've assembled to work on housing issues. I recognize these conversations have moved quickly, and we appreciate your leadership during a crisis time and when inaction on housing policy results in real-life consequences for individuals and families. Overall, I'd like to impress upon Council that we need a comprehensive strategy to address housing affordability. We need a variety of policy tools working in concert to address the full spectrum of housing needs, from ending homelessness with investments in affordable housing infrastructure to ensuring that fair housing laws are upheld so that housing discrimination ends now in our lifetimes and isn't passed on to future generations. It includes the construction excise tax, general obligation bonds, inclusionary zoning policies, and legal challenges. All the pieces need to go together for a comprehensive housing strategy because everyone deserves a safe and affordable place to call home in the city of Portland. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jeff?
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. Thank you for having us here today. It really is a momentous and exciting day to be able to talk to you about this first impact fee for affordable housing, essentially. I'm Jess Larson with the Welcome Home Coalition. We are a coalition of over 140 organizations today. We're all the usual suspects, like the frontline workers in homeless services and the developers of affordable housing, but we're also neighborhood associations and healthcare workers and educators and small businesses, because as you know, our housing crisis is impacting all of us. And at Welcome Home, we're working to address the historic affordable housing crisis that has been before us with our community members with the lowest incomes. And in order to address this part of the housing crisis, we know that the only solution to getting rents down to $200 and $300 and $400 a month, which is what is affordable to a senior on Social Security or a mom raising a couple of kids on a minimum wage job, the only way we can get rents at this level of affordability is by investing in the public infrastructure of affordable housing. And so that's what's very exciting about this day, is we're for the first time saying affordable housing is part of our public infrastructure, and like the infrastructure systems of parks and schools and roads, we are going to make add affordable housing to that list and give affordable housing its impact fee, because we value it as part of the infrastructure that makes our community great for everyone, and that's how we need to start building our city, and I believe this is the right step. So we at Welcome Home are calling for you to keep it 100 with the construction excise tax, and that means dedicating to all 100% of this revenue to affordable housing. We're glad to hear that support. And we know this won't go the full distance. We know we have thousands of more homes that we need to be able to build, and we're going to have to ask Portland voters to support a bond measure next, and we'll be calling upon you to help lead and support that effort. And when we do, we have to show voters and Portlanders that we're doing all we can with all the tools that we have, and this is the next step we need to do in making sure that the booming market is a part of the solution, as well as Portland property taxpayers. So thank you for your support. Thank you for keeping at 100, and we look forward to continuing this work for building back our city's infrastructure of affordable homes.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
I do have one more question for Mr. Dame Dyke before you leave. You not only have done a lot of development in Portland, but you've done a lot of development on brownfield sites. Do you think there should be an exemption in this tax for brownfield development?
No.
And why not?
There are brownfields and there are brownfields. So at some point, I would love to have a discussion with you, but I could cite you some illustrations of something that might be called a brownfield, but because of circumstances, it probably should not be treated any differently than anything else.
And you don't having developed projects on brownfield sites, you must not, I'll put these words in your mouth and take them or leave them, you must not think that this is going to make the difference in their feasibility, that this 1% tax would make them infeasible to develop?
Maybe I answered your question
obviously not
the wrong way or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So you think it is not going to make the difference as to whether they're developable or not?
I don't think so. But you got to be, again, I'm having difficulty getting on the same page with your question. I guess I'm trying to answer it a different way. So let me use an illustration.
Please.
If a Portland Development Commission piece of property is going to be sold to somebody, and we know that it's contaminated, but the property cannot be excavated, right? So you can't have underground parking. And the only thing, the dirt that's going to come off of there is from, let's say, auger cast piling. And it's going to get hauled to Hillsborough. And then you're going to submit your bill to PDC, who pays it. And they're going to submit the invoice to the railroad. Yeah. Do you give that a break?
Yeah.
I say no. That's why I said no, because there's so many different circumstances regarding these things. Let's go back to over a decade to South Waterfront.
Yeah.
People wanted to call the land that we bought a brownfield. I kept saying, why do you want to do that? Well, we can get a $70,000 grant if we call it a brownfield. Well, okay, we're going to build a mega million-dollar project here, and we're going to hang a bad name on the dirt for you to get $70,000. It didn't make sense to me then. It still doesn't make sense to me. So you got to be very careful about spreading this thing over widely over everything and say, this gets a break because somehow there's a tag of brownfield on it. So
that's very helpful. Thank you.
Can I clarify question? I haven't seen an analysis of what the impact is. So I appreciate trying to get to a yes or no, but what I'd settle for is looking at the sites that Metro has identified as brownfields by some agreed upon definition, recognizing that in our comprehensive plan we've just committed to an extraordinarily ambitious plan of remediating those brownfields, many of which are in areas served by underrepresented communities. And also understanding that we've been told by everybody, including the legislators leading this effort, like representatives from Inner Northeast, that the only way this is ever going to work is if we come up with a financing scheme which creates adequate incentives. And that's what the legislature has been hung up trying to figure out what that is. My only interest is, if we're adding an additional cost, is that going to be a barrier? And if not, are we going to end up picking it up through the back door through an incentive plan? I don't know the answers, so that's why I've asked staff
I don't either.
And I think your point about brownfields is perfectly valid. We have the benefit, though, of Metro identifying lots of brownfields that we have in turn said are brownfields, and we're proposing over a period of time that they're going to be remediated. So it may be that there's not enough of a cost barrier through this tax. My question was, has anyone done an analysis so that we can evaluate that question?
If they have, I don't know about it.
And every property.
And we all know that, you know, you don't want to hear my speech again. The world runs on arithmetic, and unless this stuff pencils, none of it works.
Yeah. Thank you all very much.
Actually, Mayor, I have a question for the panel. First of all, Jess, as a Larry Wilmore fan, I appreciate the use of the phrase keeping the 100, which I only learned the meaning of from Larry Wilmore. I just wanted to get the panel's reaction to something that Portland Business Alliance said in a letter they sent, which I bet you've seen, which is increasing the cost of development has the potential to further exacerbate the affordability problem facing the city. While the tax may be used for additional affordable units, doing so at the expense of driving market rates up will not lead to a sustainable solution. So I just wanted to give you an opportunity to give your take on that argument.
Well, we all may have a slightly different opinion, but somebody's going to pay, right? And if the person that can pay $3.10 a square foot for an apartment instead of $3, if that's what it takes to help someone in need, then they can afford to pay $3.10 a square foot for their apartment. Is there an impact? There's bound to be, because if it doesn't pencil, they're going to raise rent someplace else.
And I would just add that it doesn't all trickle down. We're not. The market is not building deeply affordable housing, and we can't leave it up to the market to stand aside and let the market or expect the market to be able to build these $200 and $300 and $400 apartments. We have to find the resources to invest in this public infrastructure, and this is one of them.
I think the idea that there's going to be a chilling effect on the market is a lot of fluff, quite frankly.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Okay, let's move to the sign-up sheet, please. I think we have quite a few people signed up. Let's start taking them in turn.
We've got 15 people signed up.
Let's go use some hand sanitizer now that you've had contact with us, Dyke. So
15?
Two or three, 15 total, yes.
I think folks, if you can try to keep it to 2 minutes, that would be helpful, but let's try to move swiftly through this list. You've waited a while, so we want to give you a chance to speak. So go ahead, please.
First three, please, coming up are Felicia Hagens, Ruth Adkins, and Amy Chow Yoon, and they'll be followed by Tara Prince